are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. What do mobster Meyer Lansky, banker John D. MacArthur, and Jack Murph the Serf Murphy have in common? The biggest secret of the century about the biggest crime of the century, that's what. Now, for the first time ever, the true story of the 1964 museum robberies and the 1966 Hendersonville, North Carolina triple murders. Based on an in-person interview with Jack Murphy, aka Murph, in 2015, the author tells a revised version of the story that Murph swore was true. This dramatic narrative of events, reconstructed from several sources, including never-before-released FBI files, takes the reader on a wild ride of adventure, missteps, and several surprise endings. You may think you know the truth, but you haven't read this story. The book that we're featuring this evening is Murph, based on a true story, the true story of the 1964 museum robberies, and Hendersonville triple murders, with my special guests, Terrence Ryerson Neal, journalist and author. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Terrence Ryerson Neal.
Thank you for inviting me, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Good to have you back. And very much, we covered the Hendersonville triple murders a couple years ago, my recollection, not so long ago. Tell us how this is based on a true story.
It is based on a true story because I had decided, well, I was trying to figure out how to tell the story because it can be very complex. And rather than just do a nonfiction kind of dry retelling of facts, I felt like it was very important to get into the characters' heads. So in essence, the story is true, but at certain points during the story where I didn't have an FBI file to recreate dialogue, or I wasn't the fly on the wall in the poker game, I took the liberty of creating what I felt was the appropriate dialogue for each of the characters who I had gotten to know very personally. And so in order to represent that, I created that story and the dialogue. And I just wanted to be honest with the readers that they would know that they are hearing or they are reading a true story, but some of the words that I use in telling the story may not have been exactly what they said.
Now, you say this is a project that's taken over 8 years of your life, starting with a fictional book called The Kill, and then the true story of the Hendersonville triple murders, as I had mentioned. Now, one of the characters that you have in here that you write from his perspective is this FBI Special Agent William Bean.
Yes.
So tell us about FBI Special Agent William Bean and his involvement in this case.
Well, when I was trying to figure out how to tell this story, of course, every story has to have a protagonist and antagonist, and I wrestled with that quite a bit. The FBI files that I received from the FBI 2 years ago were based on primarily Special Agent Bean's notes. There were a couple of other agents who wrote some files also for this project, but Special Agent Bean was the leader of the Miami FBI office in 1964 when the three, as they call them, surfer boys or beach bums or whatever they were called, Murph, Allen, Coon, and Roger Clark, left New York City after robbing the museum and fled to Miami. And he was called upon to pretty much organize the effort because they had essentially taken the jewels across state lines, which made it an FBI case. So Special Agent Bean actually is the one who, of all of the characters in these stories, would have touched on all of the different lives of each of the people involved in this, or if he didn't, he would have had knowledge of or have known about them. So I kind of used him as my narrator for the story because of that perspective that he has.
Now, you open with FBI Special Agent Bean, December 12, 1970, and this is he's at the Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yes.
Tell us what he's there for and who he's there to speak with.
Sure. Well, the reason he's there is because there was a man who was the fence for a lot of the criminals in Miami, and his name was Herman Gordon. He went by the nickname of Hy. And to be honest with you, I want to also make clear that when people read this opening chapter, I want them to know that I did not make up these particular words. These are the very things that Herman Gordon was screaming when he was there in the hospital. I took them straight from newspaper accounts, so I didn't make any of this up. Agent Bean was on a mission to try to find out what happened to the gems that had not been recovered from the Museum of the Natural History in 1964 when it was robbed in October 29th. And they had recovered the Star Sapphire of India, and they had recovered the DeLong Ruby in a pretty elaborate ransom scheme in 1965. But the remaining gems had never been discovered. And it had always been bothering him that they had not been able to find those other gems. And he had been led to believe that Mr. Gordon would know where they were. And so the opening scene is Herman Gordon in the hospital in Grady in Atlanta. Agent Bean is there, and he's watching. I don't want to give the story away, but he's watching as Herman Gordon protests that people are trying to get information from him and they're trying to give him truth serum. And that's how it opens. And it actually happened. And Herman Gordon and Agent Bean is hoping that he can find out what happened to the remaining gems before Mr. Gordon perhaps dies or passes away. And so that's how this story opens, is with that.
So continue with the what information he does get from Gordon in this confession.
Well, the interesting thing about Herman Gordon is that he was not really a criminal. He was but he was he was a person who enjoyed the finer things in life. He loved diamonds. He loved all the gems and things that criminals would bring to him, and he'd often collect them, keep them for himself. But he was also a fence. He was probably the number one, if not the one, he was in the top 10 of all the fences in the United States, perhaps the world, passing goods that criminals had stolen through different hands and collecting money and commissions and all this sort of thing. And so he had gotten word that a person who said he had organized the crime in 1964 with the robbery of the museum wanted to talk, and he was going to name names and tell everybody who was involved. And Herman Gordon, who had now been arrested and was serving a sentence in the same place where this other person, his name was Richard Duncan Pearson, where Agent Bean was coming to meet with Mr. Pearson, had heard about this. And so Mr. Gordon said he wanted to talk too. And so Agent Bean sat down with Herman Gordon, and he heard a tale that completely just blew him away about what really happened and why the story happened. Now, I might add that I got this information, the original story about how this crime actually occurred, in my 2015 interview with Murph the Search. But right. I decided not to have Murph tell this story because he only knew parts of it. And he was actually not the major player that everyone thought he was. And as time went by as he claimed to be. He was not as important as he let on. And so that's how this begins, is Herman Gordon giving Agent Bean this fantastic tale about how the crime actually occurred and why.
Now, after he hears this incredible story, which he thinks is almost unbelievable, how does he regard the story?
Well, Agent Bean actually believes Mr. Gordon. He doesn't have any reason. Gordon doesn't have any reason to be lying. And Agent Bean actually does believe him. So that's not a problem for him. But it's when Bean realizes that when Gordon is no longer available to interview any longer, other people at the FBI, particularly his boss, who was Mark Felt, and then eventually J. Edgar Hoover, realized that a tape confession of Herman Gordon telling this fantastic story simply isn't enough. There's got to be corroboration from other people. So Bean gets very frustrated. He believes that he finally is on the trail of finding these gems that he's been looking for 6 years. And now all of a sudden, after somebody's told him where they might be and who might have them, the FBI is telling him it's not good enough. You're going to have to go get more information and find somebody who can corroborate this story that Herman Gordon's told you. Otherwise, you know, we can't let the public know about this.
Part of his obsession, Bean's obsession, is over one of these diamonds, the Eagle Diamond, and right, a 16-carat, 12-sided sunshine yellow gemstone. Why the obsession?
Well, the Eagle Diamond is one of the most, well, still is, it is one of the most fascinating gems that has ever been discovered, particularly because it was where it was discovered, which was in Wisconsin. Diamonds, as you know, are quite rare, and they only occur in very specific places in the world, particularly in an area where something called a kimberlite forms. And millions and millions of years ago, a kimberlite had formed on the western coast of Canada. And during the glacial age, when the ice was pushing everything south, it pushed a bunch of kimberlites down into the state of Wisconsin. And then in the 1800s, when a man was digging a well, he pulled out this particular stone, which he thought was topaz, and he took it to a jeweler who paid him like a dollar. It was very minimal. I don't recall the exact amount. And then later on, he found out that he had been taken, that the jeweler actually knew what he had, but he didn't want to tell him. So it's a very rare, unusual diamond. And Gordon, everybody knew after the gem was stolen that this diamond would be the hardest one to find, because most likely it would be cut. Yeah, because of the fact that it was still in a raw state. So it mm-hmm. could be cut and refined and actually put into different settings, and nobody would ever be able to trace it. And that's one of the reasons he was particularly interested in Herman Gordon, because Herman Gordon has spent quite a few years of his life learning everything he could about diamonds, including how to polish them and cut them and set them in stones. So Gordon not only had an obsession with diamonds, but Bean really, of all the gems that could be found out of that collection that was stolen in 64, Bean just really had an obsession with finding this particular stone, or at least finding out what happened to it.
With Bean found out from him that there was big names associated in this story, Mayor Lansky,
right,
John D. MacArthur. Tell us what Bean thinks of these names and its connection to this story and this robbery.
Well, everybody thinks this is a pretty fantastic story, that they don't quite understand at first how these people could be involved. But when they discover that, well, I don't know if you want me to actually give away perhaps one of the reasons why this robbery took place, but it was actually the idea of Meyer Lansky to do this as a favor to help out John D. MacArthur, who was in a bind. I don't know how much your readers know about John D. MacArthur, except maybe the fact that his foundation sponsors a lot of shows on PBS, but he was a pretty cheap, nasty old man. And He was actually the second richest man in the United States when he died in 1978. He made his money in a very unscrupulous way with mail order insurance. Mm-hmm. A lot of people sent in dollar bills to John D. MacArthur, and he became very wealthy with that. But he was a skinflint. And his brother, Charles MacArthur, was an author and a playwright. He wrote a play called Front Page, and he was a journalist in Chicago. He married Helen Hayes in the 1950s. They had a daughter who died. And then they adopted a young man who became James MacArthur, who was actually on Hawaii 5-0. Mm-hmm. So the implication was that Helen Hayes was a patron for this museum in New York City, the Museum of Natural History. And it was not doing very well. The museum was not doing very well. It was in all the newspapers, in fact, that they needed money, they needed patrons. And then the World's Fair was there in 1964. And they were changing over from DC current to AC current, and the alarms were disconnected. Well, Helen Hayes needed some money to give to the museum because she was a patron of this museum. And she asked her brother-in-law, John D. MacArthur, if he would donate some money. And he really did not want to do the donation. So he said, I can get publicity cheaper than what she wants from me. So if you guys... anybody help me out and figure out why in the world I have to give her money and how I can get that museum some publicity so that they can get donors. And Meyer Lansky just comes up with this plan. Let's steal something. And then we'll play a little game and ransom it back. And it'll be in all the newspaper. And John, you can pretend like you're this big hero and come in and ransom something for $20,000 and you'll be off the hook, and they'll have donors and lots of publicity. And you know, John D. MacArthur at this point is not really involved. He just kind of asks for some help. And then Meyer Lansky asked Herman Gordon and Richard Duncan Pearson to get involved and figure out if that museum can actually be robbed. And if so, can they do it? And he said he'll foot the bill and help out with expenses. And so they Richard Duncan Pearson and Herman Gordon go and case the place and find out that Helen Hayes was right. The museum alarms have been disconnected. The place is just a mess, needs to be, it's just ripe for robbing, and sounds like a good idea. And so that's how it all gets started. It's just a kind of a fluke, an idea, but it was not three Beach Boys who just happened to be in New York City in October 1964. There was much more to it. There was much more reason behind it than these guys just showing up there one night.
Now, Bean finds out the why, and the team that's assembled. He eventually hears about this team and the skills that are assembled with this team, and also the intricate planning by Dickie Pearson.
Right.
Let's talk about that.
Well, I think people would have to understand that in 1964, particularly along the coast, the lower southern coast, southeastern coast of Florida, it was sort of like the Wild West was in the 1800s. It was all the rich people were going there. They were building magnificent homes and spending the winters there. And you could find celebrities and wealthy people, and they were just flaunting their jewels and going to parties and socials. And it was a ripe climate for jewel thieves. And I have to tell you, it was just amazing when you go back and read some of the newspaper articles of what was occurring there, everywhere from Ava Gabor being robbed at gunpoint while she's in one of the resort hotels, to people putting diamonds in their cars, to in their trunks when they go to dinner, after whether going into the restaurant or something, or coming back out, or some boater going down one of the waterways in Miami, and suddenly a bag flies over the bridge and it turns out to hold a bunch of jewels and a gun. It was just a wild, wild place. And so there were a lot of jewel thieves in Southeast Florida along what was called the Gold Coast. And they were robbing people constantly, which is why Herman Gordon was there as a fence. He was the one who was taking a lot of this stuff and selling it or keeping some for himself, breaking it up. And so one of the things that happened is that Richard Duncan Pearson actually was, he needed money. He wanted, he was a spoiled rich brat. His great aunt actually was Isadora Duncan, the famous dancer who, if you'll recall, was killed when her scarf wound around the axle of a car in France and it jerked her back and broke her neck and killed her at a fairly young age. Mm-hmm. He was also from a family of actors, and his father was a wealthy stockbroker, and they had retired early and gone down to Florida. Well, Pearson, he was a trust fund kid, as they would refer to him today, but he was constantly getting into trouble. He had no mind for managing money, and he was constantly broke. He was a philandering guy who just was constantly having affairs despite being married. And he got involved with a guy named Alan Kuhn. Alan Kuhn actually was one of these jewel thieves in Miami who was going up and down the waterways, and when people weren't home, pulling his boat up behind their dock and going in and robbing them and making a pretty good money. He was living in a very expensive high-rise condominium complex on Brickell Avenue in Miami. Pearson found out about Kuhn, and it turned out that Dickie Pearson actually had a pretty good mind for planning and being devious. So it kind of worked out pretty well that Kuhn, who had a boat and was very sneaky and small and could do that, worked pretty well with Dickie, who seemed to have a really good mind for logistics. His only problem was that he really liked drugs. And he really liked women, and he really liked money, and he also liked alcohol a lot, and he just never knew when to stop. So as successful as he could have been at many things, he was always doing something that tripped himself up. Nevertheless, he was called upon to put together a team to go in and rob the museum in New York City. And so he was actually the mastermind. It was not Jack Murphy. It was Dickie Pearson who was the one who planned everything for this robbery.
Now, there is the plan that is set out for this robbery, but Dickie Pearson is not loyal to anyone except himself. What does he have as an alternative plan? What is his orders, and what does he think about doing?
Well, the entire thing was built around one idea, and that was steal one gem, something really important, big, that would make a lot of news, steal one gem, hide it someplace, do the ransom thing, get publicity, and MacArthur would ransom it, and that would be that. It would all be taken care of. So he was told, we're stealing one thing, the Star of Sapphire of India from the Museum of Natural History, and that's all you're supposed to do. Just steal that one thing. Can you do that? Oh, yeah, we can do that. But Dickie decides, his greed, again, gets the best of him. He decides that, no, we're going to tell them that we're going to steal one thing. But he tells his boys who are with him that are probably going to do this, while you're there, and as long as you're stealing the Star Sapphire, let's pick up a few other things. Let's make it worth our while. So fill your bags up, boys, when you get there. And nobody will be the wiser, but we'll be a lot richer for it. So
now, you talk about getting the intel about the alarms, and these alarms not working whatsoever. They case out the place, and they can see that there's an access point. They have the team and the members that can do the jobs. Like you say, Kuhn is a small guy and known for this kind of crime anyway. So what happens with the plan, and how does a museum in London come into this plan?
Like I was saying, that there was supposed to be one stone taken, and just one stone. But after Pearson decides secretly that he wants to steal all these other things, Herman Gordon says to Meyer Lansky, well, you know, as long as we're doing this, there's some, and we've got this team assembled, there's some stuff in London that I have had my eye on for quite a long time at a natural history museum in South Kensington. And Meyer Lansky says, well, if you think that it'll be helpful, and Herman Gordon says, oh, yes, this would be good practice for them. The museums are very similar. They go over there. We can practice on that museum. The alarms are working there. So if they can get past those alarms, then they can obviously do the New York City robbery. And it'll help me out too. We'll get these industrial diamonds that I would really need to have. I really would like to have. But there's one other thing that Herman Gordon hasn't told Meyer Lansky, which is he wants to actually hit a lot of other places in London the next day after they planned the robbery for the museum there. So the museum in London is a diversion for a major heist of multiple gem houses in Hatton Gardens, which is the diamond center of London. I know that people are going to say, oh, this didn't happen. This couldn't possibly be real. I guarantee you that all of these things that I'm telling you actually did happen. The museum in London was robbed. They sent a message to New York City. Scotland Yard did. They sent a message to New York City after the robbery in October. The robbery in London occurred at that museum in July. No, they had no idea who did it. It was amazing because they had these fancy alarms. The thieves got in and out in such a quick amount of time. But the strange thing was that they didn't really take anything that was that valuable, just a bunch of industrial diamonds. And nobody could figure out why they did that. But then the next day, there was these multiple robberies, all unsolved in July of 1964. Then the robbery in New York occurs in October of 1964, and Scotland Yard immediately reads the articles about this robbery in the newspapers, and they send a message to the FBI and say, listen, the way this robbery is described, the one that occurred there in New York, the one that you guys are right now working on trying to solve, it sounds an awful lot like the robbery that occurred here in London in July. Could you work with us and tell us who you find and maybe we could work together? Well, anyway, they ignore London. Nobody answers. Nobody ever gets back with them. So this incredible robbery takes place in London, multiple places, and it was done by the same gang as a practice for the one in New York City. And the only problem is the one in London went really, really well. And the one in New York, as most people who have read about this story know, well, they got away with it, but they got caught pretty quickly because of carelessness and just, you know, they got really cocky about their abilities to do things. And so the New York robbery was not quite as successful as what happened in London, but nobody ever knew that these guys were actually involved in what occurred in London too. So that's that's what happened.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Terry, to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Talkspace. We often forget that a big part of showing up for the people we care about is first caring for ourselves. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and it's the perfect time to find one thing you can do to prioritize your mental well-being and write yourself a permission slip to get it done. Working on your own mental health can be challenging. Therapy can help you understand your strengths and use them to create closer relationships. Getting started is easy with Talkspace. Connecting with a licensed therapist to start focusing on your mental well-being. Therapy has been very beneficial to me, and Talkspace has a unique approach needed for so many. No matter where you are in your mental health journey, talking to a therapist makes a huge difference. Talkspace takes some of the pressure off that first step. It's a more flexible and convenient way to get high-quality care. Plus, there are several payment options to choose from. With Talkspace, you can talk to a licensed therapist 24/7 without needing an appointment. They have thousands of therapists across dozens of specialties. So whatever you're dealing with, Talkspace has the expert support you need. Consider this your permission slip to put your mental health first. Match with your dedicated therapist today at Talkspace.com and use promo code TRUEMURDER during sign-up to get $100 off your first month. That's $100 off at Talkspace.com, promo code TRUEMURDER. Now, Terrence, we talked about that Scotland Yard contacts New York authorities and tells them about the similarities between the London heist, museum heist, and the New York heist. But you say it doesn't take long before some of these criminals get arrested for other things.
That's correct. Yeah. Although nobody is aware of what happened in London, Murph and Poon head to Miami immediately after the robbery in 1964. And they give the jewels to Richard Duncan Pearson, who they actually have a party and they show off the jewels that night. And the jewels are never seen again, but it's not long before the New York City Police Department is contacting the FBI in Miami and saying, we have these characters here in a hotel for nearly a month. And we think they're the ones who were involved in this robbery. And we hear that they're in Miami now. And would you help us? And it wasn't long. They were arrested within days. They were arrested within days. But there were no gyms. So they were actually arrested, but they were not held right away for a while.
Another complication is this. When they were casing out the London Museum, an Inspector Bliss from Scotland Yard was noticing, wasn't he? Was paying attention.
Well, it was pretty obvious that these guys had their eyes on something. But now Richard Duncan Pearson was there in London under an alias. He used several aliases when he traveled. But the guard, who was a security guard, he actually worked for Scotland Yard. He saw these two people, Herman Gordon and Pearson, keeping an eye on these diamonds. And but they left. And that happened in March 1st. That was the first time they actually went and cased that museum. And then in July, when they come back, there actually is an encounter between the inspector and Pearson again at the hotel. But the inspector still doesn't quite make the connection. There's a robbery about to occur. And so, but luckily he does remember these guys and he does document what occurs in 1964. So he has done a pretty good job of documenting Richard Duncan Pearson being in London at that time in 1964.
Now, how does Agent Bean get to find out more about these industrial diamonds and the entire plot and plan for these museum robberies and the connection to Meyer Lansky? Tell us how he proceeds with this and the involvement of another interesting character, Harvey St. Jean.
Oh, well, you know, as I said, Miami was full of criminals in 1964. There's probably quite a few there now even, but it was pretty crazy. And a lot of the mob figures, organized crime, were in Miami too, primarily because they had been in Cuba for much of the 50s. And of course, Castro kicked everybody out in early 1960, confiscated everything, but they were still living there. So there was an attorney who represented most of the criminals in Miami. His name was Harvey St. Jean. Now, so when the guys were caught in Miami, the robbers for the museum in New York City, when the guys were caught, Harvey St. Jean represented both of them when they were brought back to New York City and during their trial in New York City. And he also represented Herman Gordon. And he represented pretty much everybody who had a criminal record. And the discovery of how London occurred was first confessed to Agent Bean by Herman Gordon
right
in 1970. And then Bean had to get this corroboration. They knew that two people were still in jail, Murph the Serf and Alan Kuhn. And because Gordon had implicated Kuhn in the London case, they decided that they would interview both of them. And so Bean goes to Kuhn and asks him if he would like to get out of jail, would he be willing to corroborate Gordon's story by telling Bean what happened, how it happened, who was involved, everything that he knows, but would he do it without his lawyer, Harvey St. Jean? Because Bean suspects that St. Jean is much more embedded in these crimes than he has ever let on. Mm-hmm. And so that's what happens. Bean goes and talks to Alan Dale Coon, who corroborates pretty much the story that Herman Gordon has told. And he does this primarily because he needs that corroboration to know before he goes in to talk to Pearson, who is sitting there waiting for him with Harvey St. Jean. So he needs that corroboration. He needs the true story. He needs to know that everything is accurate before he goes in and listens to Richard Duncan Pearson, who was the original person who started all this about confessing everything, to know whether he's really going to be telling him the truth, especially with Harvey St. Jean present. So that's what happens.
So tell us about how Bean uses St. Jean and drives a wedge between St. Jean and Pearson.
Well, when Agent Bean finally is able to get in to speak with Richard Duncan Pearson, he realizes that Markfeld and Hoover were absolutely correct. He did need that corroboration of Herman Gordon's story. He is so glad that he was able to get the truth out of Alan Coon. And he's armed with a lot of information. And when he gets into the interview with Richard Duncan Pearson, Pearson essentially shows his true colors, which he has always pretty much shown, that he's a spoiled kid. He's not going to tell Bean anything about his true involvement in these crimes. He just wants out of jail. And so Bean is able to pull in some information that Coon and Gordon have given him in order to determine that St. Jean is actually not acting in the best interest of Richard Duncan Pearson, who the client that he's sitting there representing. And in fact, he is able to finally determine that St. Jean was in fact helping to set up Richard Duncan Pearson all along so that he would be convicted of several other robberies, although not implicated in the museum robberies. And one of those robberies in particular is when, after the museum robberies occur, Richard Duncan Pearson is arrested in Macon, Georgia, and robbing a jewel store. And he has ransom money that was paid by John D. MacArthur for the DeLong Ruby in his satchel. Now, he claims he doesn't know a thing about how that money got there, because he claims he did not have that ransom money. Well, in fact, as we find out, Bean is able to pull Harvey's involvement in these crimes into the open so that Richard Duncan Pearson finally becomes aware of the fact that Harvey St. Jean is actually as bad for him as he is for all these other clients, and that he has been two-timing him in many other ways, including helping to stash that ransom money in the satchel that's found by the police. And so St. Jean has actually set up Richard Duncan Pearson to be arrested in Macon, Georgia, by having Richard Duncan Pearson's wife put the money into the satchel before he goes off to do the robbery. So I'm sorry, I don't think that as a speaker I'm the greatest. I think I did a much better job of writing this particular interview with Pearson in a very dramatic way so that all of these little pieces fall into place. But I think it's actually one of the best things I've ever written, to tell you the truth, this interview with Pearson, and the way that Bean is able to drive this wedge between these two guys. And essentially, Richard Duncan Pearson fires Harvey St. Jean on the spot and says, go away. And that's actually the only time that Pearson shows any backbone. And finally, he is able to at least come clean on a few things with Agent Bean, who in the end does not give him what he wants, which is a jail card. But he does teach him, I think, a fairly decent lesson about how you do things and you can't trust anybody.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talk about Pearson knowing that St. Jean had betrayed him big time, but there's still more for Bean to understand and find out. And again, it's the, where did this ring go? Where did this Eagle Diamond go? So tell us about how Bean finally puts everything together, where that Eagle Diamond went and why.
Well, in the story, that is what Bean is after. More than anything, he wants to find out what happened to all of the gems and try to recover them if he can. But more than anything, he wants to know what happened to the Eagle Diamond. And Richard Duncan Pearson, Herman Gordon, other people have all pointed the finger at one jewel thief who was in Miami at the time. And his name was Harry Henry Sittner.
Right.
Sittner was an incredibly rich character who deserves his own set of books because he led a wild life. But it's discovered that St. Jean had the diamond, had some of the gems, and it went to Harry Sittner. And Harry Sittner was actually going to give it to Herman Gordon. And Gordon did not tell Bean what happened to the diamond, but Herman had left a booklet that also pointed towards Sittner. And finally, by looking through this booklet and realizing that Sittner was also this guy named Sittamore, because they had various aliases, they're able to determine that the diamond had gone to, had been split and put into several rings, and then it was stolen. And one of the pieces was stolen, one of the rings was stolen, and it went to Harry in a little place called Hendersonville, North Carolina. He had given the ring to a woman that he was dating. He had been coming to the mountains here for decades, and he had given this ring to the woman. He had also used some of the jewels to set up a major counterfeiting ring in the mountains. When he was arrested here in town, he was found with tens of thousands of dollars worth of gems in a hotel room. And when the gems were all collected, nobody knew where anything came from. So, but there was one man in particular, and his name was Lawton Gay, and he had been given instructions to try to find this ring. And he came to town, and that brings us into the murders now, the triple murders, as to why they happened. Everyone always suspected that organized crime was involved. And in a way, it was, because the ring had actually been intended to go to Meyer Lansky, but instead Harry had taken it and given it to his girlfriend. When it was discovered that this girlfriend had the ring, well, she was able to pass it off to her mother, who was dying of cancer. And when the ring was discovered, it was discovered on the finger of this woman's mother, and she was murdered along with two other guys by Lawton Gay, who was trying to find the ring. It's just an unbelievable story of people being in the wrong place at the wrong time and having the wrong things, and they lose their life because of it.
You talk about that this woman looked very much like her mother, and because these gangsters were, murderous gangsters were after her, she was advised and took that advice to sacrifice her mother because she looked so much alike and put the ring on her finger. Incredible details of those murders in Hendersonville.
Well, it is a terrible thing that this girl did this, although her mother was dying. She was very ill. And the girl realized that if she didn't do this, she would be dead. So she got, I guess, whether you want to believe she did the right thing or not, her girlfriend told her this was the only way that she could save her life, is to put the ring on her mother's finger, put her driver's license in her mother's purse, let this Lawton Gay think that he's actually gotten Christina, not Louise, who is the mother. And that's exactly what happens. And Paul's the mother. And Christina actually gives her mother a huge dose of morphine, which is sitting right there on the bed. And so her mother's near death anyway, when Lawton Gay hauls her out and takes her to an open field on a hillside over a lake, can't get the ring off her finger. And so after murdering her with a shotgun, because can't get the ring off, he cuts the finger off and gets the ring that way. And the sad part about this whole story is that everyone thought it was because this woman was hanging around with two gay guys and they were into voodoo. Nobody ever realized that this was all about a ring and a diamond that had been cut and stolen from a museum in New York City. That's exactly what happened. And for 40 years, a man in town carried around the woman's finger as a reminder to people who did know the story to keep your mouth shut and don't tell anybody the truth. And he died last year.
This case with Bean, once he had all this information about extortion, conspiracy, triple murder, and other crimes, what was the word from J. Edgar Hoover and Mark Felt from the FBI?
Well, you have to understand that there was also, there's a lot of dynamics that occur in this story, particularly in regards to organized crime. And organized crime had always been in the pocket of government, particularly in the 60s, and particularly with JFK, who had worked with Meyer Lansky on the Bay of Pigs, and some of the characters in the story who I know about. That's a completely different line of discussion I don't want to get into. But the long and the short of this is that the organized crime people were in charge. And they had gotten a free ride for helping out the government with the Bay of Pigs.
Right.
And this particular story would have implicated Meyer Lansky in a crime. And he had been given assurances that he would never, ever be hauled into jail because he was in his golden years and he had done what he was supposed to and he had gotten promises. And so J. Edgar Hoover just says, well, I'm sorry, but this crime is going into the vault. And nobody's going to talk about it. And you guys, you want to keep your jobs. You're not going to talk about it either. And so it was hushed up. And so the legend of Murph the Surf was born. And that's what happened.
You talk about Saint-Tropez, France, January 3rd, 1972. Can you tell us about that meeting?
Well, this was the only element of Bean's life that I fictionalized. He was not from France, but I had him going back to his home in south of France because I needed him to find someone who had left. And he was quite surprised to run into this person. I'm not going to actually give away the entire point of the story, but I am going to say that Bean is finally satisfied, happy, because he has discovered finally what has happened to the Eagle Diamond. And that is how the story ends. And so I don't want to actually give that part away is that actually what happens, but Bean does find out what happened to the Eagle Diamond and he's satisfied now that he has done his job.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Terrence Ryerson Neal, for coming on talking about Murph based on a true story, the true story of the 1964 museum robberies and Hendersonville triple murders. For those that might want to find out more about this book, can you tell us where they might find out more info?
Sure. Yeah, it's on Amazon. There is a hardcover edition. There is a paperback edition. And the ebook will be available on June 15th. And currently, that's the only place that it is available. I might also, if you don't mind, tell you that I do know that there is a documentary coming out in the summer about Murph. Mm. So you might want to catch that. It's being done by Imagine Entertainment. So that's how.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Terrence Ryerson Neal, Murph, based on a true story, the true story of the 1964 museum robberies and Hendersonville triple murders. It's been fascinating. Thank you so much, Terrence Ryerson Neal.
Thank you, Dan.
Good night.